From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
I believe that there are angels walking amongst us, and they are not necessarily seen. They come sometimes as dogs, sometimes as dreams, as little taps of intuition, and sometimes they come as humans.
Stories about angels. They're among the most cherished stories in all cultures, all languages, practically from the beginning of recorded time. There are angels in the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the Quran. And of course, in Christmas carols and stories. And maybe they're not just stories. According to polls, 78% of Americans believe angels really exist.
One friend of mine was living on the East Coast, and her father in Ohio had a stroke, and he had to go to Mass General Hospital. Every week, she would fly to Ohio, get her father, take him to Massachusetts, take him to the hospital, and then return him to Ohio. One winter day in Boston, she was pushing him up the hill when she slipped on the ice and fell and let go of the wheelchair. And she watched in horror as the wheelchair went sliding down the hill, careening toward a four-lane highway with no fence. She got to her feet. She ran down the hill, knowing that she was not going to manage to catch the wheelchair with her father strapped into it before it hit the highway and the car hit it. And just as it got to the highway, two men suddenly appeared, very well dressed, in business suits. One on each side of the wheelchair stopped, each one with a wheel. She came pounding up to her father, to the wheelchair, and she bent over to him and she said, "Are you all right?" And then she turned to thank the two gentlemen, and there was no one there. And there was no one anywhere nearby. They had simply vanished.
That's one of the stories Sophie Burnham tells in her Book of Angels, her best-selling collection of encounters people believe they've had with angels. We'll hear more about supposedly real-life encounters with angels in a bit. But first, well, the one place most of us have seen angels is in the movies, where it has to be said, they don't always get a very warm welcome.
Who are you?
I'm an angel.
You're an angel? Well, I knew it. I've been working too hard.
Well, who are you, then?
I told you I'm your guardian angel. I know everything about you.
Well, you look about like the kind of an angel I'd get. Sort of a fallen angel, aren't you? What happened to your wings?
I am a seraphim. The highest choir of angels. You do know what an angel is, don't you?
How do I know you're an angel?
Well, you mean aside from the fiery entrance and the expansive wingspan? You want more proof? Fine. How about tequila?
No matter how poorly prepared we are to encounter them, on screen or off, angels are a fixture in the movies. Start listing the films you've seen in which angels figure prominently. I'll bet you'll be surprised how many you can come up with. Film critic David Edelstein has some thoughts about why we seem to find them so perennially appealing.
I think they come out of a fundamental longing in all humankind. You know, for many people, the modern view of tragedy is summarized by that famous poem of Stephen Crane that goes, and I don't usually memorize poetry, but this one is short enough. A man said to the universe, "Sir, I exist." "However," replied the universe, "that fact has not created in me a sense of obligation." Now, angels are a sign that someone up there is watching and someone up there feels a sense of obligation. I mean, on your most basic level, even if a bad angel comes down, even a fallen angel, it's a sign at least that there is some spiritual or metaphysical hierarchy in the universe, and that people are paying attention, even in the most glancing way, to the petty affairs of human beings.
We think about this most often, I suspect, around the holidays. I mean, It's a Wonderful Life comes out and Clarence gets his wings. Cary Grant comes down as the bishop asks for help, and Cary Grant comes down.
But, yes, that's rather interesting. Those figures are rather interesting. In the first place, you very rarely have God coming down. I mean, God is the ineffable, and, you know, not even Jesus really talks to God in the New Testament. Most of the time, it's an angel, and the way angels are often portrayed is as petty bureaucrats.
Of course, I'm not one of the more important angels. I just happen to be assigned to this district temporarily. You see, we're everywhere, helping people who deserve to be helped.
It's really amazing to me to think that somebody up in heaven is paying attention to, you know, there's this movie called A Life Less Ordinary, you know, that an angel would come down and be a matchmaker between Cameron Diaz and Ewan McGregor, or an angel would come down in Angels in the Outfield and help a baseball team. You know, it's really, it's incredible chutzpah on the part of the human race to think that anybody up there cares enough to intervene.
They always come down as ordinary people. Are there any that don't do that? Are there movies you can think of where angels are, for lack of a better word, more angelic?
Angels have a supernatural cast in Angels in America, which is probably the most consistently worked out of the modern angel tales. The conceit of Angels in America, and for that matter, Kevin Smith's Dogma, which so outraged Catholics and the Catholic Church, the conceit is that God has vanished. In one case, in Angels in America, the AIDS plague is just confirmation that God has taken a break, taken a vacation, gone AWOL. In the other case, the Kevin Smith film, he's somehow, as a result of an accident, in a coma in a hospital in New Jersey. Now, Angels in America has its AIDS-stricken character prior have a series of visions of an angel breaking through the ceiling, coming into his hospital room, and calling him prophet, and telling him that he has to prepare himself for divine revelation.
Greetings, prophet! The great work begins! Prior Walter, long descended, well prepared.
No, I'm not prepared for anything. I have lots to do.
American prophet, tonight you become American eye that pierceth dark, American heart all hot for truth.
What's interesting is that Tony Kushner's play, and also the movie directed by Mike Nichols, builds to a sort of tribunal of angels that this character Prior visits, and in the course of which he decides to renounce revelation. He basically says, I am not going with you. I am not dying. I am not going to ascend to your plane. I am going to go back to the secular world with all its messiness, with all its injustice, with all its death. So in the end, the movie ends up kind of embracing the messiness of the world in lieu of accepting divine revelation.
That's not unique, is it? I hadn't thought about it until you began explaining it that way, but there are other movies like that. There was that, what was it, the Nicolas Cage movie a few years, A City of Angels.
Well, let's start with Wings of Desire, directed by Wim Wenders. That's a very beautiful kind of expressionistic German film in which angels descend on modern Berlin, and they're privy to the inner thoughts of mortals. Now, what Cities of Angel is a remake, is an Americanization that puts Nicolas Cage squarely on the Hollywood sign. I mean, he literally lands on the Hollywood sign, which is pretty indicative of where the movie goes.
Do you come here a lot?
I live here.
What do you do?
Oh, I'm a messenger.
Oh. Well, what kind of messenger? Like a bike messenger?
No, I'm a messenger of God.
He renounces his angelhood to become mortal, to be with Meg Ryan. And she's so happy that she goes for a bike ride, and she closes her eyes in ecstasy, and she runs straight into an oncoming truck. I think the message of the movie is that life's a bitch. So yeah. Nick Cage is stuck on Earth as a mortal, and Meg Ryan is flattened.
On the other hand, you mentioned Dogma, the Matt Damon, Ben Affleck film. I suppose it's uplifting in some ways because they discuss over and over again the interaction of God and man, but it's hard to see it as uplifting, and there's an awful lot of
blood and guts.
Blood and guts.
Dogma, remember, is about primarily fallen angels, not real angels. They're actually played by Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, and they have spent 2,000 years stuck in Wisconsin. I think it's Wisconsin.
Yes, it
is. And they're desperate to get out of it, and they're kind of psychotic.
You all right, man? Your eyes are kind of...
My eyes are open. For the first time, I get it. See, in the beginning, it was just us and him, angels and God. Then he created humans. Ours was designed to be a life of servitude and worship and bowing and scraping and adoration. He gave them more than he ever gave us. He gave them a choice. They choose to acknowledge God or choose to ignore him.
You know, all I'm saying here is that one of us might need a little nap.
You asked also about angels not taking human form. Well, these are very recognizable stars, but at the same time they have, it's so interesting, they've got... The wings are really cool. The wings are sort of made out of genuine flesh when they come out. They're sort of flesh, blood, and cartilage. And when they're clipped, you know, these angels sort of howl in pain. So it adds this whole sort of physical, visceral thrust to them. But they're fallen angels. The whole conceit of the movie is that God's will and Catholic dogma has sort of come into conflict. The Catholics have sort of taken God's will in their own direction, and they've codified it, and they've codified it badly. And since God is now in a coma, these two angels see a loophole that they can take advantage of. And if they succeed in their mission, God will be shown to be fallible, and the center will not hold, and the apocalypse will destroy all life in the universe. So there is, you could say, quite a bit at stake.
I'm to charge you with a holy crusade.
For the record, I work in an abortion clinic.
Noah was a drunk. Look what he accomplished. And no one's asking you to build an ark. All you got to do is go to New Jersey.
I was about to say that this is an example of the way in which Hollywood has helped us to move toward a much more cynical view of the universe. But back to It's a Wonderful Life, the Jimmy Stewart, Frank Capra movie, that actually may not have come from a great belief in the goodness of people. We forget that it came right after World War II, when the world was looking very different from what it had before. And this was a way to look at people's nature. We think of it as a frolic, but there were some serious things being said.
So you still think killing yourself would make everyone feel happier, eh?
Oh, I don't know. I guess you're right. I suppose it'd been better if I'd never been born at all.
You've got your wish. You've never been bored.
The impressive thing about Frank Capra, I find his sentimentality a little much in places, but at his best, he actually made a series of extremely bleak films, films that reflected some of the social realities, that reflected a certain amount of modern cynicism. You know, It's a Wonderful Life is so moving, not because it's a frolic, not because it's saccharine, but because it allows you to see the protagonist at very, very low ebb, on the brink of suicide. And then it says, you know, all these things have happened to you, but think of what the world would have been like without you. It is a little bit of a narcissistic fantasy, but at the same time, it's a very resonant question. Who are we to say, are we so egotistical that we believe we're allowed to remove ourselves from the world? Look at how many people depend on us, how many people we love. Look at how many lives we've touched. So that is a very inspiring message.
Daddy! Zozo! Zozo, my little ginger snap, how do you feel?
Fine! Not a smidge of temper.
Not a smidge of temper. Hallelujah!
Hello?
David Edelstein is the film critic for Slate.com, and his reviews can also be heard on NPR's Fresh Air.
Well, I hope I see you later. 'cause it's time for me to go. That's my ride that just pulled over, and it sure was good to know you. Well, go answer your calling, go and fill somebody's cup, and if you see an angel falling, won't you stop and help them up? 'Cause we are each other's angels, and we meet when it is time, and we keep each other going, and we show each other signs.
Chuck Brodsky, We Are Each Other's Angels. Next, what should we make of people who say they've actually seen angels in the flesh? Are they deluded, mistaken, naively optimistic, or just lucky?
This story happened on New Year's of the year 2000, when a woman named Nan Munsing and her husband and her brother-in-law and his wife, four of them, were in West Virginia at their country place. And their country place is a house in a little town, but a tiny, tiny township. And so it was New Year's Eve, and it began to snow. Around 10:30 at night, they went out to get a start on the snow, was the way they put it, and sweep the sidewalk. And while they're sweeping the sidewalk, and it's dark night and a moon and no cars, nothing moving in this tiny, tiny little burg, a man they see walking down the street from the right, and he has a pack on his back, and he's just walking along deep in thought. And as he came up to them, they were so astonished at this man coming from nowhere that they tried to engage him in conversation. He wouldn't answer much. They said, where are you coming from? He said, oh, not far. Where are you going? And he said, I don't know. It was clear that he didn't want to talk, and they let him pass, and he disappeared around the corner. And then they thought, you know, that was really strange. And they put down their brooms, and they followed his footprints. And it turned the corner, and they're still following his footprints, and the footprints stop, and there was nothing there. Now, what do you do with that kind of information?
We'll have more of Sophie Burnham's angel stories later this hour. And could genetic research explain modern angel sightings? Find out when we come back. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. According to polls, a whopping 78% of Americans believe in angels. 95% of us believe in God. Now, a startling new book makes the claim that faith and belief are hardwired into our DNA. Dean Hamer is one of the country's leading geneticists. By day, he runs a lab at the National Cancer Institute. By night, he's been investigating the link between science and spirituality. Now, it's been known for several years that there's a genetic component to spirituality, but Hamer's carried this a bit further and found one specific gene that seems to be involved in this trait. He calls it the God gene, and that's also the title of his new book. Steve Paulson asked him what this God gene does.
That gene handles a type of brain chemical that are called monoamines. And these are brain chemicals that are very much involved in the way we feel the universe around us. They're involved in our sense of consciousness. And we think that it's really changes in consciousness that are at the very heart and core of spirituality. So when you look at the spiritual experiences, for example, of Jesus in the desert or of Muhammad in his dreams, they always involve changes in consciousness, a sort of different perception of the universe. And these brain chemicals are involved in exactly that.
Now, when you say there's a gene that triggers this change in consciousness, what does that mean?
Well, it simply means that this is one of many different genes that are involved in the metabolism or the handling in the brain of these chemicals that ultimately lead to changes in the sense of consciousness. So it's not like there's a gene for God. Rather, there's a gene that influences the chemistry of the brain, which in turn influences our feelings of spirituality. Everybody has this gene. It's not something that's unique to some people and not found in others, but different people have slightly different versions of the gene so that some people may naturally be more spiritual than our others.
Oh, that's fascinating. So you're saying that if we have an extra dose of the gene, I guess, that we're more likely to believe in spiritual matters or have spiritual experiences?
I think it's more a matter of people being more easily channeled into spiritual experiences. But that's not to say that everybody can't have such experiences. In fact, there actually have been studies that have shown that this sort of sense of spirituality and self-transcendence can be practiced. For example, when people meditate for a year or two, they develop higher levels of self-transcendence. So it may be a little bit easier for some people, but everybody can do it. Everybody can have those feelings.
And you're not talking about religion here. I mean, this really has nothing to do with whether we're brought up in a church or not.
Absolutely. One of the most important distinctions, I believe, is between the feelings of spirituality and actual religiousness, that is, being a good Christian or a good Jew or a good Muslim. And in fact, the psychologist Abraham Maslow, who developed the whole idea of this spiritual scale a half a decade ago, was himself a very devout atheist. His father had been a rabbi. He was very much against the church, against organized Judaism. And one of his proudest accomplishments was that when he gave his little spirituality test to various people, he claimed that the people that scored the lowest were priests and rabbis and ministers. So that certainly is a distinction between being religious and being spiritual.
What about angels? Do you think there's a genetic predisposition to believe in angels?
I think that there probably is, especially given that all different religions believe in angels. They may call them different things, like Buddhist Vadas, and they certainly have been around ever since at least we've had written down religion. My own guess is that it's really a confluence of two different influences. One is this genetic predisposition towards spirituality, which includes believing that not everything is as it appears, that there's some things that can't be scientifically explained. And a second influence, which is the very strong tendency of human beings to anthropomorphize, that is to find something human-like in everything that we see in the universe. And I think you put those two factors together and angels are a very logical consequence.
And when people talk about angels, they usually talk about this kindly presence. I mean, that the sense that these angels are looking out for us. They are our guardians.
Absolutely. And of course, everybody wants to be looked out for. Everybody wants to make a connection. I think the anthropomorphization part of it comes from the fact that in the long run for humans, it is better to put a human or at least an animal face on something than to make the mistake in the opposite direction. For example, if you're walking around in the forest and you see something and you think it might be a bear, it's better to mistake a big boulder for a bear than it is the vice versa, because in the first case, you'll protect yourself even though you don't need to, but in the second place, you'll get eaten up by the bear. So when good things happen to people, we often like to put a human face on it, even if it seems to defy logic right at the time.
Now, you can certainly understand the psychology of this. It's comforting to think or to believe that there are these angelic presences out there. But scientifically, where might this genetic predisposition come into play?
Our guess is that the genetic predisposition actually helps people in many ways, including by improving their health. And this would include psychological health, that sort of sense of optimism that you need. I mean, after all, we all know that eventually we're going to wither up and die. It's kind of a depressing forward life for us. And so the idea that there's some sort of afterlife out there, that there are angels helping us, that there are good things to come, is something that I think is good for humans psychologically. There's also now a lot of evidence that faith and believing actually is good for people's physical health, and that belief, whether it's in religion or God or perhaps even in angels, that sort of belief actually prolongs people's lives. It helps them to get over diseases more quickly and has real direct benefits on physical health. So that, of course, would be a very direct selective advantage for this type of belief.
You're basically saying that if you believe in bigger things, chances are you'll be better off as a person?
Yeah, exactly. And for me, it was quite interesting. When I started working on this book 5 or 6 years ago, I was sort of a typical scientist. That is essentially an atheist. I didn't really believe in any of this stuff. It couldn't be proven to me. It seemed kind of ridiculous to me in some senses. But as I worked on the book, I took it upon myself to do some religious experimentation and to attend various types of religious services and get involved in various types of religious practices. And I found that when I got involved in Buddhism in particular, in Zen, and started meditating a little bit, that it was really quite miraculous, I have to say. You know, that it's actually possible to change your sense of consciousness and your connection to things by just sitting on the floor and not thinking, essentially. So I guess I had a bit of my own conversion experience in the course of working on this interesting topic.
Do you believe in God?
I'm a big believer in the power of belief. I've seen it work real wonders in my own life. I've seen it work wonders in other people's life. You know, to me, the most interesting thing about being alive is that we just sort of go through our lives and we see the world around us and we just assume that's the way the world is, the way we're seeing it. But it doesn't take much more than a little bit of meditation, or for some people, a spiritual experience, or for some people, suddenly being confronted by an angel, to realize that things aren't always exactly as they seem, and that we may be living our whole life in one particular way when things really are actually different than that. And that's a very profound sort of revelation. I think that's really at the heart of the power and the appeal of spirituality to humans throughout the times and throughout the universe.
Dean Hamer is one of the country's most prominent geneticists. He runs a laboratory at the National Cancer Institute. He spoke with Steve Paulson about his recent book, The God Gene.
What will you see as you awaken? Bright light drives away all fear. What will you think at this new dawning? Where will you go in this new year? Is an angel watching over, guardian saving us from harm? Maybe if we dare to dream of white wings folding soft and warm.
January Lullaby by Coop Boys and Simpson. 60 years ago, four friends had such a powerful and unexplainable encounter with angels, or something, that their story's still being discussed. In fact, if anything, it's gaining ground. Now, to tell the story, we have to go back to 1943. And the city of Budapest.
Die große Zeit ist jetzt angebrochen. Deutschland ist nun erwacht.
It was the eve of the German invasion of Hungary. A young woman named Gita Malas was talking with her best friend Hannah one day, when out of Hannah's mouth came an unfamiliar voice. The voice said it was an angel and it had a message for her. for the next 17 months, until they were deported to Nazi concentration camps, Gita, Hanna, and two other friends met weekly and took dictation from the angels. Gita, the only one of the four to survive the war, was able to preserve their diaries. 30 years later, they were published as the European bestseller Dialogue avec l'Ange. Now American actress Shelley Mitchell has created a one-woman play based on the book. It's called Talking with Angels. It opened in New York last year and San Francisco this year. Anne Strainchamp sat down with Shelley Mitchell recently to talk about it.
It opens with Gita as an old woman, which she was. She died in 1992. So I come out in the first maybe 5 minutes of the play, I'm, of course, impersonating Gita at that point, and give a little background information about the circumstances surrounding this event and underscoring the fact that these people were ordinary people. They were not into seance or astrology or tarot, that they were reading ancient texts looking for personal meaning, looking to understand what it means to be alive on earth. That's how they lived. This was how they passed their time. They had their own little consciousness-raising group, for lack of a better word. And then I actually start the evening with the first real dialogue, which was directed at Gita herself. And then I, of course, change characters quite suddenly and become Hanna speaking the angel voice to Gita.
Watch out. Soon you'll be asked to account for yourself. It's time for you to transform yourself. The seed is not sown on hard ground. You'll be tilled by endless searching, and what has been good will become bad, and what has been bad will become good. Do you know me? Do you know me? We will meet again.
That's the actual first dialogue that Gita experienced.
Now, this was all happening during the Nazi invasion of Hungary. What was actually happening to Gita and her friends at the time? And the three of the friends were Jewish. Were their lives in danger at that time?
Well, they lost their lives. In March of 44, the Nazi invasion came into Hungary and everything changed at that moment. So they were hiding in Budapest from that initial deportation of 500,000. And then a priest approached Gita and asked her if she would be the commander of a sewing factory that was actually a shelter for 100 Jewish women and children. It was set up by the Catholic Church and some sympathetic leaders in the Hungarian government.
So this was a Schindler's List kind of arrangement.
Absolutely, right? Schindler's List, with the twist that Gita wasn't making any money herself, and, you know, all she wanted was to shelter her friends. By November of 44, the Nilash, they were the Hungarian Nazi Party, began persecuting people who seemed to be hiding Jews or things that were suspicious in that way, and they were discovered. The clever thing that Gita did in the meanwhile was befriend the neighboring SS contingent. There was an SS officer and his entourage that had moved in next door to their factory. So the German SS said they would protect Gita and all of the women. So Gita cut a hole in the fence between their two gardens, the factory garden and the SS garden. It's a story kind of like that movie The Pianist, where this German SS officer saved 100. Not only him, his entourage helped the women escape during the final attack from the Hungarian Nazis, and all the women survived the war, except a group of 13 who were elderly and sick, and Hanna and Lily, Gita's friends, all stayed behind and were trapped and volunteered to be deported because the dialogues were in notebooks that we would call like school notebooks. They were just in ordinary black and white notebooks, and they each had their own set. But they felt that if the Hungarian Nazis did not have enough people to deport that day, that because of the threats they had made previously, that Gita would be shot on the spot, and then all those notebooks would have been lost. So they wanted to preserve the dialogues that badly, and they were deported to Germany and died in March of 45. They almost made it to the end.
You know, one of the many, many things that people lost in the Holocaust was faith in God. Didn't Hannah and Gita and their friends begin to wonder if the angels were real, why weren't they helping?
That is a key observation and a key question. Transformation of suffering is a big part of the angel's message, that awareness and release of suffering, and they often talk about death as being an illusion. What is death below is life above. You too are dead and live eternally. All else is time and illusion, is waves breaking on the shore, an infinity of small deaths, that is life. Cells die, new ones are born. Human beings die, new ones are born. It's not death that is bad, but the unfinished task. So they felt that there is a task that they could complete within whatever time they had on Earth alive, and that completing their task was the important point, not just survival. So I am Jewish myself, ethnically. I'm not a practicing Jew, but this message touched me so deeply, their perception that this life was not the only existence we had, that we are existing on other levels. So it has fulfilled me as an actor, an actress, on the deepest levels to be able to put my force behind an evening like this.
Shelley Mitchell's one-woman play is Talking with Angels. She talked with Anne Strangechamps. Do angels always come to Earth as human beings? I mean, if they can take any form they want, why be limited?
In this story, a woman wakes up in the middle of the night with a dog barking outside. And you know that horrible, persistent way that a dog has of just going, ruff, ruff, ruff. And finally, she gets up, she's going to throw a shoe out the window at this dog. And she sees a beautiful German Shepherd on her front lawn. And next to the German Shepherd is a little 2-year-old baby barefoot in the snow. And she goes downstairs and brings the baby indoors. And the dog, the moment that she opened the door, stopped barking. And then the dog went away and, in fact, is never seen again, never belonged in that neighborhood, had never been seen before and was never seen again. The little girl, it turned out, belonged to a family a block or two away, and her mother had put her in the back seat of the car to drive to her mother-in-law's for Thanksgiving, and then she had gone inside the house to get the other children, but in the time that she had gone to get the other children, the little baby had gotten out of the car, and the mother had driven off without her child. But anyway, there was a dog on the lawn barking to wake up somebody who was never seen again.
Sophie Burnham is the author of The Book of Angels. I'm Jim Fleming, and we'll talk more about angels after this. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Thank you. often ask for your email through our website at ttbook.org, and many of you have responded. Pamela Burns, listening in San Francisco, wrote, "It's Sunday evening, and I've just listened to several hours of programming this evening on KQED, yours being the last, mainly on the topics of art, originality, creativity, discovery, etc. Every single voice I've heard has been a male one. I know many brilliant artists, musicians, and original thinkers who are women. What about these?" You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. There's an old Jewish tradition that every time God speaks, an angel comes into being. It's a lot of angels. Most people can come up with a name for at least one or two, like the archangels, Gabriel and Michael, or Lucifer, the fallen angel. But in ancient Jewish legends, there are thousands more. Rahab, the angel of the sea, Raziel, the messenger of God, Metatron, God's scribe, and so on. Howard Schwartz is the author of more than a dozen books of Jewish stories and legends. His most recent is called The Tree of Souls. There are hundreds of angel stories in it. They're drawn from the Bible, the Talmud, the Midrash, Kabbalistic literature, and medieval folklore. Schwartz told Anne Strainchamps a few of his favorites, like the one about the angel of friendship.
There's a Jewish tradition that every person has his own unique light on high. I guess it's kind of the idea of a higher soul. And that when we meet another person that we become close friends with, that the two lights, our light and the light of our friend, merge. And out of that merging comes a new angel. And this angel thrives for as much as a year. But if you're separated from your friend for more than a year, then you have to say a blessing where you thank God for raising the dead so that God will bring the angel of friendship, to life. So that every friend has, between all friends, there is an angel of friendship. Just a beautiful idea.
One of the most beautiful myths you found is the one about the angel of conception.
Yes, yes. This is really one of my very favorites, too. The idea here is that there is one angel whose name is Lila, and Lila means night. The idea is that she is charged with God to bring the soul and to make the soul enter, you know, the seed, and to implant the seed in the womb. And then Lila stays in the womb, you know, with the growing embryo, and reads to the child from a little light inside of the womb. This, I love that detail. The history of all the secrets, you know, of knowledge, so that the child knows everything, all of the history of heaven and of hell and of the future and of the past. It reads everything, all the wisdom that there is. And then when the child is born, the angel waits there just as the child emerges and strikes the child above the lip. And this is what creates that little strange indentation above our lip. And what the angel is saying basically is, shh, you know, now don't tell anybody all these secrets. Mm-hmm. And then at that instant, the child forgets everything. But, you know, that doesn't matter. It means that at some level, I would say the meaning of this is at some level in our unconscious. We know everything, but we spend our life relearning it.
Hmm. Can people ever become angels?
This is wonderful. I tell you, this is one of the cleverest of all the Midrashim, that is to say, the rabbinic legends. This goes back to the story in the Bible where Jacob wrestles with the angel. He has just, you know, escaped from his uncle Laban with, you know, his wives and his servants and his flocks, and they've crossed the river Yabbok. And he's exhausted. And then he hears that his brother Esau has come with an army on the other side and is waiting for him. 20 years later, he hasn't forgotten. He's still angry with him. And poor Jacob lays down by himself on one side of the river, and he goes to sleep. And an ish comes. It means a man, but this is traditionally interpreted to mean an angel. The angel wrestles with him. And they wrestle all night. And finally, they wrestle to a standstill. And Jacob says, "Tell me your name." He says, the angel refuses, but he says, "Then bless me." And the angel says to him, "Your name will no longer be Jacob. Your name will be Israel." And of course, Yisrael, which, by the way, can be interpreted to mean one who has wrestled with God. Hmm. And from this point on, of course, he becomes the patriarch Jacob. He changes from being the sort of immature trickster that he is in the earlier texts, and he really becomes a patriarch. He is transformed. And, of course, the whole nation of Israel is named after him. Well, in some of the rabbinic explanations, which are just delightful, it says that instead of saying to Jacob, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, your name will be Israel," that actually Jacob was an angel, the angel Israel, the highest among the angels. And he had descended to earth and become a human. And he had forgotten that he was a human. And God sent this angel, right, Uriel, down to earth and said, go, it's time to bring, you know, the angel Israel back to heaven. And so the angel is fighting with him and saying, you're not Jacob, you're Israel.
What about the fallen angels? Were they,
the fallen angels.
All the angels weren't, they weren't also always good.
Right. This whole tradition, and it's an enormous tradition, grows out of Genesis 6, where it says that the sons of God, you know, married the daughters of men. And the question is, you know, in the rabbinic interpretations of this, who were the sons of God? What the rabbis say is there were two angels whose names were Shemhazai and Azazel. And they, you know, they went to God and they said, look, you know, we can see that the world is full of sin. Don't you really regret having created man? And God says, he says, you don't understand. He says, there is a force on earth called the Yetzer Hara. This means the evil inclination. And whoever lives on earth is subject to this force, and it's this force that's causing them to sin. And the angel says, ah, he says, if they were only stronger, you know, they could resist it. They said, for example, if we were on earth, we would resist it. So they said, listen, let us descend to earth, and we'll prove to you that we can remain pious. So they make this bargain with God. They descend to earth, and they take on human form. And their intention was to be righteous, but as soon as they saw how beautiful the daughters of men were, they started lusting after them, and they quickly gave in to sin. And then they did terrible things. They started revealing the secrets of heaven to them. They started teaching them all sorts of dark secrets about magic and about how to entice men and how to make jewelry and how to make themselves beautiful and attractive to men and all these kinds of things. And in the end, they were punished for this. Shemhazai was hung upside down from the heavens and becomes a kind of astrological collection of stars. And Azazel, who refuses to repent, is cast down into a, you know, very much like Lucifer or like Satan, is cast down into a canyon and hung upside down there.
Is there an angel of death?
Absolutely. Of course there's an angel of death. King David, for example, somehow learned that the angel of death could not take a person who was studying the Torah. And then he also learned that he was destined to die on the Sabbath. So from that time on, he spent the entire Sabbath studying the Torah. And the angel of death, who was waiting to take him, you know, was very frustrated by this. So what did the angel do? He went outside, and he shook some trees and made a big noise. And King David ran out onto his porch to see what had happened, and the angel took him.
Oh, but I love this tradition of the chutzpah of Jewish writers and rabbis who try to outwit the angel of death.
Exactly. Outfox the angel of death. Precisely.
Howard Schwartz has written more than a dozen books of Jewish stories and legends, including Lilith's Cave and Gabriel's Palace. His most recent is called The Tree of Souls. Anne Strainchamp spoke with him. Now, what I want to know is this. If the heavens are full of angels, and if they've been visible to human beings, why can't we all see them? I mean, why do some people get to see angels and others don't?
I believe that there are angels walking amongst us, and they are not necessarily seen. I have a friend who is an investment banker, and we were talking about this 15 years ago. And he said, I've never had an experience with angels. You talk about this stuff, it's never happened to me. And then he said, but you know, I remember when I was a little boy, I was 10 years old, and I was alone at home playing with my wood carving set, and the scalpel slipped, and it cut my finger to the bone. I could see the white bone. And just at that moment, the doorbell rang, and I wrapped a paper towel around my finger. The blood is pouring out of it. And I went and answered the door, and there was a woman there in a white uniform with a black bag in her hand, and she asked for my mother. A nurse had just come to the door. She asked for my mother. I said my mother wasn't in. She came and bandaged up my hand and went away. And you know, I just never thought anything of it. I didn't even tell my mother she'd come.
I think all of us, almost everyone, has these experiences. And they're very beautiful. And the people who are most aware and most awake have them a lot because they recognize them. And for the other people, I'd say, ask. Ask to see it. And then sit back and hold your seatbelt because you have no idea how fabulous it's going to get.
Jane Sibbery and Katie Lang, Calling All Angels. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Got questions or comments about the hour? Want to know more? You'll find all you need at our website, www.ttbook.org. You can purchase a cassette of this program through the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the Angels program, number 1226B. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Anne Strange Chimps, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, and Mary Lou Finnegan, with engineering help from Marv Nunn and Kirill Owen. Musical assistance this week from Judy Rose and Laurie Skelton.
PRI, Public Radio International.